This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course on the air right here at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 PM. It's the pre-election edition where we'll examine campaign finances as we head into Election Day. Does the one with the most money always win? Well, Dr. Peter Brusso and legislative analyst Melissa Avstray will be here to discuss. We'll also be joined by energy analyst Rob Barnett to talk about some key topics from the campaign trail, including Keystone, nuclear energy, and of course the EPA. But we'll kick off today's program with BGov defense analyst Rob Levinson and budget analyst Cameron Luthy comparing President Obama to Governor Romney in the world of defense. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Great to be here, Alan.
BGov has a gigantic 2012 election coverage section on the site itself if you want to take a look at www.bgov.com. And one of the areas, as we examine a lot of the key topics that are hot buttons during this year's election, one of which is defense. Obviously, defense is very important, but there are some fundamental differences as we take a look at a Romney plan versus a President Obama plan.
Well, in terms of, it's kind of interesting. Governor Romney, in terms of strategic priorities and things like that, after we've looked at it, doesn't really differ from President Obama a lot on the big issues and the big priorities when it comes to national defense.
We need to be defended.
Right. We need to be defended. He agrees with him on the issue of Iran not getting a nuclear weapon. He agrees on the pivot to Asia. He agrees on the Afghanistan withdrawal. So there's not a lot of difference. Now, on the spending side, and Cameron will probably talk a little bit more about this, because he did a lot of the math. But if you project it out about 10 years from where Governor Romney wants to go, which is about, he has said his goal is 4% of GDP, and where the current plan is under President Obama as expressed in his 2013 defense budget request, which projects spending out. When you do the math, the total difference over a 10-year period is about $2 trillion. So it is fairly significant. And Cameron, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, and it's important, I think, to understand some of the assumptions that are built into these numbers. First of all, Governor Romney has actually a more modest set of assumptions about GDP growth than the Congressional Budget Office, which I think is interesting on the face of it. The second thing is that his advisors have said getting to 4% of GDP for defense spending is a goal. We don't necessarily expect to get there immediately. We might not even get there by the end of a first term. So our assumption is he gets there not until 2016, the last year of a first term.
Okay. I want to address a couple of those points that you just made. Number one, modest assumption. Is that a safe assumption to be modest, or should he be a little bit more aggressive in his assumptions?
Well, it actually points out something of a paradox. On the one hand, Governor Romney is running a campaign that's mostly about the economy, not about defense, national security, foreign policy. And he's saying his approach to the economy is superior to President Obama's, and that he would be able to stimulate growth, and that would indeed help us get out of the deficit situation we're in. On the other hand, his assumptions about GDP are more modest, about 4% year over year nominal growth than the Congressional Budget Office. So it's sort of inconsistent in some ways. You could say it's more prudent to have a more modest set of assumptions, but it isn't consistent with the growth that he's talking about in terms of jobs.
In every debate, he has said, I can balance a budget. I have balanced a budget. Mr. President, you can't do this. I can do this. By making these modest assumptions, is this his track record? In the state of Massachusetts, were these assumptions made there in balancing his budget? Is that something that we could take a look at?
I don't know that it's particularly relevant, frankly.
Okay.
I mean, what happens in Massachusetts a number of years ago, I don't think the scale is completely different.
Ding, ding, ding. You just hit on something. He's taking something that he believes worked in the state of Massachusetts. This is just me pontificating now, and projecting that onto the U.S. There is no guarantee that anything like this would work. We know that President Obama has done X, Y, and Z. and we see where we are now. Am I making sense?
Well, I would say the one thing, it's very difficult to compare what happens at any state level, because a lot of governors will tout, I balance the budget. In most states, and with very few exceptions, I believe, it's required by law that they balance a budget.
Sure.
So they really have no choice. Either they've got to raise taxes or cut spending, but at the end of the day, they've got to balance the books.
Right.
Even, I think, Governor Romney got into a fight with some of his fellow Republicans in the primaries who said, you know, he bragged about what he did in Massachusetts, and I think Newt Gingrich pointed out that Michael Dukakis balanced budgets in Massachusetts too.
Yeah.
So, you know, comparing the state level, the more difficult challenge for Governor
Cameron's
Romney.
Chuckling over here.
The more difficult challenge for Governor Romney is he has made, you know, some commitments to a number of things. He wants fairly large tax cuts, which he said he wants to balance the budget.
Right.
And then he said he wants to spend more on defense. It becomes very difficult to sort of reconcile all these things. And that's why I think he's been prudent in leaving himself an out and saying, you know, that 4% number, as Cameron pointed out, is a goal. And I'm not going to get there right away. And obviously, given those other priorities that he had, you know, he may have to be fairly flexible. And the other thing I think that was important that Cameron mentioned is, while defense is an issue, this campaign is about the economy. Mm-hmm. Defense and foreign policy are not huge issues in this campaign and probably will not influence most voters. That's the general perception.
I think on the economy in general, math doesn't add up for Governor Romney, at least as assessed by most economists. However, there is some question about the effect of lower taxes and regulation on economic growth. It may help get to a balance in a way that isn't assessable by conventional scoring, the kind of scoring approach used by the Congressional Budget Office. Now, to be fair to CBO, they do factor in economic growth. They just don't give it as much weight as some of the advisors to the Romney camp.
Understood. Let's break down some of the armed forces here, because there are some differences here of note. As we take a look at the Navy, for starters, Obama plans to build 8 ships a year. Romney?
Well, Governor Romney has said, and this is one of the things he's been very specific about, he would like to increase the rate of about 8 ships a year over the next 5 years to about 15 ships a year. And generally talked about the Navy being too small for the current strategy. Again, Governor Romney agrees with the shift to Asia, but feels that a larger Navy is probably needed for that. Now, he hasn't been terribly specific about what kinds of ship he would build, other than he said he wants to add a submarine. There's currently 2 submarines in the 5-year plan. He would like to add one. But he hasn't said much beyond that. So it's difficult to assess in some ways how much more money of that, say, that $2 trillion extra it would cost, because, of course, you know, an aircraft carrier versus a littoral combat ship, there's a great difference in cost, and depending on what you build, you know, figures into that math somehow.
It's interesting. There's a very healthy and lively debate about the shift to the Pacific and whether the planned ships in the Obama budget are adequate to exercise and implement that strategy. And that's one of the critiques coming from the Romney camp. I think we're beginning, however, to see a more, how shall we say it, nuanced approach to this in the debate. And that is, it's too simplistic to just count ships. It's what kind of ships and what do you do with them and how do you combine them with emerging technologies like unmanned aerial systems and unmanned undersea systems. You can take an existing ship and you can use it the way you've always used ships, or you can add the new technology and use it in a different way, cover more sea miles in the same amount of time. So that debate is beginning to become more sophisticated.
All right, let's talk Air Force. Airplanes, obviously. I believe Governor Romney is looking to acquire more F-22s.
Right. The F-22, which is right now the Air Force's premier fighter, it's an air superiority aircraft designed to shoot down other airplanes. And basically, the original buy on these things were like 850 aircraft. Eventually, under Secretary Gates, they capped it at 187 aircraft. And the line was shut down. They're not building any more of these. And Governor Romney has talked about restarting the line and, you know, producing more of these aircraft. And we don't have a lot of numbers on this. One study that was done by RAND looked at what the cost of, say, you know, making 75 more of these aircraft after you restarted up the line. And they've come up with several tens of billions of dollars to come up with this. But it's interesting. This is probably the proposal that Governor Romney has forwarded that's been the least sort of vetted. He made it in a speech once, and he said it a couple of other times, but there hasn't been a lot more detail about how many aircraft or when. This is probably the least detailed of any of his proposals.
Well, and it also begs the question, why? What's it for? I mean, I don't think anybody really sees us going toe-to-toe with a major sophisticated power with fifth-generation fighter technology. Nobody thinks we're getting into a war with China or Russia or anybody with sophisticated top-of-the-line fighters. So it really is a question of what's it for.
Bragging rights.
As we all kind of chuckle here. One of the big things that President Obama talked about early on, I want to reduce the troops. I want to take care of the troops, bring them back home. We don't need this many people overseas.
Right. I mean, basically, the current plan over the 5 years under President Obama is basically to draw down about 100,000 troops, and that's mostly from the Army and the Marine Corps. Of course, most of these troops are actually added to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So this is sort of returning as the war in Iraq has ended, as he hopes to end the war in Afghanistan by 2014. He's sort of drawing down. Now, Governor Romney says basically he wants to sort of add back in that 100,000. And keep the levels a bit higher. And he's indicated that, you know, some of the issues that have emerged is a lot of strain on the troops with the multiple deployments and the rotations. And by, you know, putting another 100,000 people, leaving them in the force, you sort of ease that burden on the troops. So there is an argument to be made here. Like I say, some of it was due to the wars. But I think there is certainly an argument to be made that you could add more people to the force or keep more people in the force and reduce the strain somewhat.
Again, it begs the question, what's the additional end strength for? If we're not in Afghanistan and we're not in Iraq, then what do we need another 100,000 troops for? In 2000, we had 10 divisions in the active force in the Army, and it was perfectly adequate for a peacetime set of requirements. So yeah, I was one of the people who advocated for increasing the size of the Army once we got ourselves involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. But once we get out, it seems like we could go back to that level. Now, that's a big debate, but the strain on the troops was because of combat deployment.
Right.
It wasn't a strain on the troops for rotation in peacetime.
That kind of brings us full circle as we take a look at money itself. There's an easy way to save a few bucks. If you want to reduce the troop levels, then you know what? We have an adequate amount of troops post-war time.
Clearly, manpower is a huge cost, particularly as over the last decade and a half, there's been a tremendous increase in pay and benefits for the troops and for the retiree community, and Rob can speak to that.
Colonel.
Right. As a military retiree myself, I mean, you know, my health care is paid for by the Department of Defense, and this is a serious issue, the personnel cost that goes beyond any sort of temporary political campaign. Is, you know, the military budget, about a third of it goes for personnel costs, and that percentage of the overall budget is rising. And there's been a real effort to try and control some of those costs. However, some things like curtailing some of the retiree benefits for health care, for example, whenever the department proposes this, Congress sort of shoots them down. So it's been very difficult. And if you cannot restrain the cost of the individual personnel, then the only other way to solve the problem is to cut people.
Right.
And, of course, then that gives you capability issues. Less people can do less, and you have to factor that into your calculus. But this rising personnel cost is a huge issue for the Department of Defense and one that they're attempting to deal with over the long term, but it is very difficult.
I'm one of those people that I think can see both sides of the coin. I see the benefit in saving the money, but I also go back to what Congress is probably thinking. These people served our country.
That's right. And that's where, in my career, I made a mistake, probably a big one. During the buildup after 9/11, I argued for some different approaches to pay and benefits for the troops. And I don't think I really understood the political dynamic sufficiently that you can't do that in a time of war. You've got to take care of them every way you can.
Yeah.
I think the mistake I made was I should have argued for making those increases temporary for the duration of the conflict and then revert back. I might have gotten a better audience at DOD.
Gentlemen, any parting thoughts as we talk just prior to the election with regard to defense and spending?
Well, as I've said now, and we've talked about, you know, defense is not foremost on people's mind, but it is still a serious issue. You know, one of the president's titles is Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, and it is an area, unlike, say, domestic policy, where the president has a lot more power to influence. I mean, he is really, as President Bush used to say, the decider. He doesn't have to consult with Congress nearly as much. And so, you know, it is still important to look at the two men's approaches to defense and think about, you know, are, you know, who is one or the other, and how do you want, who do you want making those decisions in events where we cannot anticipate? Look at what happened in Libya or some of these other places. These are things that was on nobody's radar screen and there was no plan for. And ultimately, it comes down to the president making decisions in those areas.
Cameron?
I'll start with a quote that I keep hearing from Gordon Adams, my old boss during the Clinton administration. Strategy wears a dollar sign. But I'm old-fashioned. I really think that it's important to look at strategy first. What are the requirements to affect that strategy? And then look at, okay, how much do we need? And where can we take risk? If you just start with the dollars, you're not going to get to an optimal outcome.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, okay. Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott, joined now by Rob Barnett. He's an energy analyst with Bloomberg Government. We're walking through several issues that have become topics of conversation throughout the election, just prior to the election, one of which falls under your purview in the field of energy and hot off the presses, killing EPA rules not as easily as Romney supporters might hope. This obviously is one of the big things that Governor Romney would like to eliminate.
That's right. So you're talking about Bloomberg News reporter Mark Drajan's piece that came out just this week. And I think he makes a point that I've already been talking about with Bloomberg Government clients. And that's just that EPA regulations, much harder to roll back in practice than the rhetoric would believe, have you believe, based on things that Mitt Romney has been saying on the campaign trail.
Sure.
Years of precedent for how regulations work, and you just can't come in as a new president and do away with the things you don't like.
There are a lot of things, as we take a look at the Romney campaign, that he is touting he will undo. But just like this, it takes time to undo these things. You can't just walk in and snap your fingers. Something else that I know that they've been discussing quite heavily is the Keystone Pipeline. He's supporting it. The president, maybe not so much.
I think the president's support, President Barack Obama, is actually there, but it has elevated to a campaign issue, and I think he's moved slowly on the topic. Want to make sure all the environmental safeguards, things like that, are in place. I'd be surprised if Keystone doesn't happen, no matter who wins.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that the president can actually have a little bit of sway over. So maybe it gets done a little more quickly if Mitt Romney ends up in office.
Ah, the smell of Canadian oil. Can you smell it?
We already import more oil from Canada than from any other country. So if you've got a problem with Canadian oil, goes way beyond Keystone.
I love our friends to the north. Don't be putting words in my mouth, Mr. Barnett. Let's talk a little bit about oil and gas. President Obama wants to end some industry tax provisions. Governor Romney, what are his plans?
What's interesting, Mitt Romney has actually said that he might be open to rolling back some of the oil and gas tax incentives that are out there,
mm-hmm.
but only under comprehensive tax reform. President Obama says he would do away with them kind of in isolation, but frankly, that's neither one is too likely. I mean, it's really all about what Congress is going to do. The president just can't wave his pen and do away and change tax law. So the president or Mitt Romney, that's something that that they'd have to negotiate with Congress.
Sure. Something that is, well, relatively important, considering we have a few nuclear reactors just in this area. We're talking nuclear energy. Romney's energy plan would require the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to decide on new license applications within 2 years. Now, the current approval process can drag on for far longer than that. What does the president say about this?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a red herring, actually, to talk about the licensing issues. I mean, the economics of nuclear just frankly aren't very good right now.
Right.
So that's really the thing that's slowing down the industry. There are tons of incentives out there that the industry is not even taking advantage of just because it's very capital intensive and very expensive form of energy. And the incentives, frankly, aren't enough to get the private sector to move on nuclear right now. Unlikely either president would put in new incentives for nuclear, so I think we're going to kind of have a standstill on that type of energy for a while. one just broad thing on energy.
Sure, sure.
For all things, though, is really most decisions require congressional action. And so I think whether you look at energy or anything else, there's a little bit that's in the president's control, but a lot requires Congress.
That's BGov energy analyst Rob Barnett. As we continue our pre-election show, let's talk campaign finance. Mrs. Dr. Melissa Avstray and Dr. Peter Brusso. Hello, Mrs. Doctor.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well, doing well. Melissa has a complex about not being a doctor, but she's married to one.
And often followed by one on the show.
Exactly. Peter, obviously, we've talked a lot about money in this particular election, but is it always like he who dies with the most toys wins?
Sure. So, again, one of the exciting things about this election is the first privately financed election where both candidates are taking in private donations. And President Obama has raised an unprecedented amount of funds this year. Essentially, for every dollar that he has raised, Mitt Romney has only raised about 60 cents. So it's a whole bunch of money on the Democratic side, not so much money on the Republican candidate side.
Okay, where's all this money coming from? He's raising a lot of it, obviously.
So it's a combination of different sources. President Obama continues to do very well using small donors. He has a huge cash advantage among them. So overall, well, for every dollar that Obama has, Romney has 60 cents. Among small donors, for every dollar that Obama has, Mitt Romney only has 30 cents from people giving less than $200. So it's a very huge advantage among small donors. It's also a huge advantage among large donors, those who are giving more than $200, but not as much. It's only about 75 cents on the dollar.
Bloomberg Government has a pretty comprehensive area on the site where you can take a look at campaign finance and determine the companies for which a lot of the people who are making these donations work for. Have we seen any pattern?
Yes, we have seen a pattern emerge. President Obama has enjoyed a tremendous amount of support from U.S. federal employees. They've given him about $325,000 worth of donations. Google has accounted for about $318,000. And then you have some very top universities in the country, Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, and the University of California system, combined together account for about three-fourths of $1 million. When you look at Governor Romney, most of his money is coming from your Wall Street firms. Goldman Sachs gave him over $500,000. He's gotten $400,000 from Morgan Stanley and about $375,000 from J.P. Morgan, among other leading Wall Street groups.
Mrs. Doctor, you know, we were talking to Rob Barnett earlier, and we spoke to Cameron and Rob Levinson as well. One of the things that we've managed to pinpoint throughout the show is the fact that Mitt Romney has ideas, lots of ideas, none of which can really be enacted without the assistance of Congress. Congress plays a big role in just about everything that he does and is projecting to do.
Yes.
Where are we with the congressional donations and who's leading? What does that field look like?
So control of the Senate is a political priority that has been somewhat, I think, overshadowed by the presidential campaign. The Senate right now is nearly divided between Republicans and Democrats, and there's about 10 seats up for grabs now. So every race counts. You know, mm-hmm. who is going to end up being in control of the Senate? And you know, Peter talked about money, and one of the interesting things that I found most interesting looking at these Senate races is the level of outside money being spent. Tim Kaine, Senate candidate from Virginia, Josh Mandel, the Senate candidate from Ohio, both had over half of their donations coming from folks that don't even live in the states that they're campaigning to be the senator for. So Mandel, for example, had about 44% of his donations coming from Ohio residents.
Wow.
And the rest coming from folks that don't even live in Ohio. I think that donors across the country recognize that control of the Senate is a national priority.
Sure.
And they want to see their party maintain control.
Mrs. Dr. Melissa Avstray, thank you for joining me. Dr. Peter Brusso, I appreciate you stopping by.
Alan, it's always good to be
Thank
here.
You.
Be sure to join us next Thursday at 11, as we'll have plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.